sobers.
Something I had a family life seminar this weekend up at the Treaty Church of Christ at Treaty, which is north of Indianapolis, up between Indianapolis and Fort Wayne, up that area. Very well attended. We had a Friday night sessions and Saturday and Sunday morning, Sunday night. And so we ended it off, finished it off Sunday night with a marriage service. Remarried all the couples, renewed their vows, and we had the church decorated candles, flowers, special music, guy in the tux sang, and then we went to a lot of couples, churches filled, and they led the way, had a recessional down to the basement, had a big wedding cake punch. So to symbolize everything, they had the couple that had been married the longest cut the cake. It turned out that they had eloped. She was 16, he was 19, and they'd been married 47 years, and so they never had a wedding cake, so they had to cut the cake. We had the couple that was married the least number of years share the punch, you know, link arms and take the punch. Then they got the idea and had a couple. They were going on vacation. In fact, they had stayed over the weekend before they started the vacation on Monday to open the seminar. So they let them be the symbolic honeymoon couple. They decorated their car and had tied tin cans to it and threw rice. All good outside, and everybody threw rice as they drove out honking. They were about my age, and it was a real nice weekend. I thought it was the kind of thing that churches are having to do, is really emphasize family and work on it because of what's happening in the churches. So I should share that idea with you. When I was at Westside, we used to do that every so often. We would have a family, we did it every year. Every 4 or 5 years, we'd renew the wedding vows. Of course, a lot of new couples would come into the church over that time. We'd have a wedding service, the same thing. We'd have candles and the teenage girls would serve as receptionists. We'd have a wedding processional and renew the vows. On one of those services, I was asking the question. I said, we're going to have a wedding cake. I forget what they put on the wedding cake. I was announcing in the morning service, and I said, and what do you suppose we wrote on the wedding cake? And one smiley, Bill Hahn, if I remember Bill. He said, well, better luck next time. One of them suggested for the wedding song, The Old Gray Mary Once Used to Be. We didn't do that. But you can. it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun this weekend. A lot of hard work, but it was the kind of things the churches are doing more and more. Well, let's get to, we're on page 9 of our syllabus in this very boring section. Looking at it historically, we'll be done for too long. Let's move quickly through this. We're looking at betrothal and gifts, and we were emphasizing the last time we met the in the ancient Near East, in biblical times you would call it, the binding nature of the betrothal. Now, and the function of the dowry in protecting the woman and protecting the home. Come to Egypt, we know of no such thing in Egypt there is no evidence of betrothal or a bride price. A gift was made by the husband to the wife, kind of like many modern couples do. It's first attested to in the 20th dynasty. There may be a rudiment of an original bride price, but we don't know that. After the 26th dynasty, it became a nominal sum. In the Ptolemaic period, down between the Old and New Testament times, we know of, quote, money to become a wife, which was given by the bride to her husband. The dowry remained the wife's property and was retained by her in case of divorce. They developed the same kind of program they saw in Mesopotamia. That is, the dowry was some protection for the woman. And in this case, any case of divorce, why she kept the dowry. If you had to keep the money, you had to keep the woman. In Greece, in the early Greek period, back in the days of Homer and into the Dark Ages, a necessary preliminary to the marriage was the anguesis, or the betrothal. Now, the father of the bride promised his daughter to the groom before witnesses. The girl didn't have to be there,
but it was sort of a public statement which was legally binding.
In Hellenistic times, down the age of Alexander the Great and following, the anguesis disappeared, and the dowry, poix or phernae, that's how the Greeks pronounce, consisted of money and goods given to the bride by her family. The dowry remained her private property all of her life. Plato wished to abolish dowries in order to prevent insolence on the part of wives. Interesting. Plato said these women with their dowries, they bring it to the marriage, and the husbands and the wives were saying to their husbands, look, if you mess with me, if you beat me up one more time, I'm going to take my dowry and go home to daddy. And Plato said this is causing all kinds of insolence in wives. And you can see, can't you, how society would have been better off without it. I mean, if a man can't beat up on his wife when he wants to, I mean, what's marriage? Why, right, Joe? I mean, what's marriage all about?
One thing that hasn't been mentioned, maybe you're going to touch on it, when there was a divorce for whatever reason, what happened to the kids?
Children were the property of the man. Private property.
Just across the board, most of that time, she left, she went by herself.
As far as we know. The question was, why the children? In the ancient world, children were the property of the man. Private property.
Property of the man.
Do what you want with them, pretty much. Roman marriages were usually but not necessarily preceded by a betrothal or sponsalia, which could involve children as young as seven. And we got our word sponsor from this. We talked about this in hermeneutics class, the ancient custom of the sponsor in the first century world. In the presence of witness, the male sponsors placed an iron ring on the fourth finger of his sponsa and kissed her. They were betrothed. It's interesting, the ring was involved in the engagement. This is where we get the idea of engagement ring, came from the Romans. Later we added the marriage ring. It's interesting, women get two rings out of it, interesting, one engagement and one married. And they used iron. Now, that sounds kind of cheap, but iron was an early period, in a traditional period, early period of Rome, was very valuable. You know, don't you, that in the from the 8th century back, even before that, even later than that, iron was a precious metal, very hard to make. And you would have iron jewelry. And so later on, after the tradition prevailed, they used iron. One of the problems with gold was they had a problem alloying gold so it would not be so soft. You can see a lot of gold rings. The common people didn't wear gold rings because the gold would be so soft that it would wear away or break or bend. Very hard. You know, you can't have very much gold in a ring and wear it. You know that, don't you? Because it would be so, gold is very soft. The purer the gold is, the softer the metal. So they would use iron. And they would put it on this finger. This is where we got it from, the ancient Romans. Putting the ring on the fourth finger. It is explained that the ring was placed on this finger as it was the direct, they believe this ring was directly tied to the heart. And where they got that idea, I had the foggiest notion. But the ring finger was connected to the heart. The dos, or dowry, dos is simply the word for gift, was a very important factor in most marriages. The size of the dowry was fixed after hard bargaining between the families.
And with the Romans, unless the wife stipulated the return of the dowry, the husband legally acquired ownership, as opposed to the Greeks. The husband could keep the dowry. In other words, it became his. Now, whether he had to give it back or not depended upon the arrangement that had been made. Understand? The families might, depending on what kind of bargaining position you were in. If you had a good dowry and a good bargaining position, and you kind of arranged a marriage, you could say to the husband, the family of the groom, the parents of the groom, look, okay, well, we'll make this deal, but we're going to write in the contract that if he divorces her and sends her back, the dowry goes with her. If they were in a position to do that. Now, they were not in a position to do it. They wouldn't do that. But while they were married, the dowry was his. A woman could not own private property, of significant private property. That is, she'd have to be a sponsor. The dowry belonged to him. We look at betrothal in the Old Testament. This is important to Bible studies. Betrothal in the Old Testament created a legally binding relationship. Even before the marriage, Jacob called Rachel Ishti. That's how that's pronounced. Ishti means my wife. Got that? He called her my wife before the wedding. I'll give you citations in the scripture. You don't take time to look at that. The mahar, or bride price, represented compensation rather than actual purchase. That is, the daughter, I think we mentioned this before in another connection, the daughter had value to the father, so the bride price was to repay the father for his loss. Remember Jacob had to work for Rachel? He got Leah first and had to then got Rachel after 7 more years of work. That was to pay the father, Laban, for his loss. It was not a bride dowry as such. In Genesis 34:12, Shechem is going to pay any mahar for Dinah. For example, you wonder, I'll bring my Bible with me to look these up. The references are in your syllabus. In Exodus 22, the law provided that one who has seduced an unbetrothed virgin has to pay her mahar. What does that mean? See the thing? The significance of this law? You see, this girl, she was a virgin, and she had value to her father, but if she had been seduced, this young virgin, she's probably talking about a girl 12, 13 years old. If she was seduced by a man, then chances are no other man would want to marry her. She would not be a virgin. So the father would be out the price he would have gotten if he had arranged a marriage for her. Okay? So, if a man were found guilty of seducing this girl, destroying her virginity, then he had to pay the father as if he were taking her for a wife. He didn't take her. Or he might, but he didn't have to. That was not the point. But he had to pay the price as if he had taken her for a wife. It's interesting that when the thought was, when you took away a girl's virginity, you deprived her father of value. Instead of silver or goods, an act of valor or service was at times performed to win a bride. Somebody read Genesis. Somebody read Joshua 15, 16, and 17. Turn to that very quickly. Yes.
Caleb said, I will give my daughter in marriage to the man who attacks and captures.
Yeah. The man, I've got this daughter, and anybody wants her, can't come up with the money if he will perform this act, capture this city, then that will stand for the mahar. If you want a significant deed, significant service, would serve as a mahar. The Shelohim, literally parting gifts, are mentioned but twice in the Old Testament. I give you the citations. In the last passage, the Pharaoh presented the city of Gezer to Solomon as his daughter's dowry. Well, Pharaoh gave a whole city. Well, in the rabbinic period, by the rabbinic period, that's the time from the Pharisees on, the later period, the bride price became purely nominal. Hillel maintained that anything worth a peruta, which was the smallest coin, was sufficient. We're down to pure symbolism now. You know, you went from a money or an act of valor down to pure symbolism. Give the bride's father a penny, and that's enough. In this period, ordinarily a year intervened between the betrothal and the nuptials, that is, and the wedding. Rob Judah held that a man should not betroth a woman until he had seen her. I like that. It's a good idea. If you want to get engaged, look at the woman before you make the contract. You don't have to, but it's a smarter, good idea. Make sure you see her. Once made, a betrothal was legally binding and could not be broken except by divorce and death, as in the case of the earlier period. So the rabbis, what I'm saying is, perpetuated that tradition, that custom. And I mentioned here, the serious legal implications of betrothal are evident in the fact that when Joseph discovered before his wedding that Mary was pregnant, he could have publicly denounced her as an adulteress, but was disposed to put her away privately. That he was going to, if, since she became pregnant, she was an adulteress technically, even though he'd have never taken her to wife because of the betrothal. And he could have publicly denounced her, but he was going to divorce her privately. Well, the early Christians, to move on, followed the sponsalia. The settlement recording the transmission of the dowry was read before 10 witnesses to protect the wife. You got that? You get 10 witnesses, and the husband could not back out later on the marriage agreement. Such a betrothal agreement could not be broken without discredit. The espoused parties were kept carefully apart until the wedding. A custom we don't follow today, to be sure. Well, but the Christians were very clear about that. The Christians basically followed the Roman, what we're saying is the Christians followed the Roman method of betrothal or engagement, but they were very careful to make sure that even though they were engaged, that they did not come together until the wedding.
And come together in what form?
Well, they were not allowed to be.
Was it done in protection for them because they had already made that decision and it was better?
Because sexual purity was such a rarity in the pagan world, the Christians were going to make sure that they didn't duplicate that Roman custom, premarital sex.
They were technically married, even though they hadn't.
They were legally betrothed. But the Christian, what we're saying is the Christians took steps to make sure that. There was no premarital sex. The Romans were not so picky about that. Pagans. Okay. Well, we come to marriage contracts now. The ancients often had, here it's interesting that today, because. There's a return to marriage contracts in our society. And there's a renewed interest in them. Why? Well, because of the prevalence of divorce, couples are careful about marriage contracts because women want to protect themselves and men want to protect themselves. There's been many cases of women being exploited. Both men and women... What used to happen today, men and women who have money, both cases, both men and women who have money, often they get, somebody will sort of seduce them into marriage, live with them for a year, and then sue them for divorce, and on the basis of community property, take half of what the person had. You don't think, ask Johnny Carson about that. He's been had a couple of times. And but women often, it happens to women too. So because of that, many today, these people are saying, okay, we'll get married, but we're going to have a contract that you cannot take anything out of the marriage and bring into it, or whatever they agree on to protect them financially. Also, and women often enter it for their own protection. But marriage contracts were a part of the ancient world. The Code of Hammurabi rules that a woman is not a wife without a raksatu, or a contract, a written document. Some scholars say it could have been oral. At Nuzi, they found some of these contracts. Remember, that's one of the first places where they found evidence which opened the window to the patriarchal age, Mari and Nuzi, the cuneiform tablets, records. At Nuzi, they found contracts that obliged the wife who was barren to provide a handmaiden to bear her children, to bear him children. Genesis. Now, you got that? What does that? What account in the Bible does that illuminate? No, there's more specific than that. Abraham and Sarah and Hagar. Sarah has often been condemned because she gave Hagar to Abraham, and Ishmael was born. But it's very likely that Sarah had no. It's very likely that Sarah had no choice. She may have had a contract. They agreed to do that. That seems immoral to us, but not to them. You see, remember I said the children belong to the father? And a man wanted male heirs. And some of the contracts provided that she had to be able to bear children. It comes out that she couldn't have children. Then she would have to make some other arrangement. One of her handmaidens or something would have children. And the children would become the property of the man. And the barren wife would become the mother. They would put it on her knees, symbolizing that the child was hers. Then the father could accept it, not accept it, usually would. But she had a responsibility to do that. Why? Because to the ancients, if a woman could not give her husband children, it was always considered her fault. Sometimes it wasn't her fault, but it was considered her fault. And therefore, she had not met her responsibility. A man had a right, in other words, to children. Now, you must understand that this, while this seems kind of stiff to us, you must understand that to the ancients, as it is to the Orientals today in some places still, the right to have children, the having of children, was not an option. Today, with our economic system, with our culture, having children, all other things being equal, is an option. That is, there is no economic necessity to have children other than tax deductions. And they cost more than you save them. Take my word for it. Children are very expensive. But you see, in that world, in the biblical world, children, where most people farmed, you needed children to help you earn a living, and children were your social security. That is, when you got too old to work, you need somebody to take care of you, your children did that. Therefore, a man, it was a necessity, they would see, to have children, the kind of necessity that does not necessarily exist today. In other words, most people do not today depend upon their children to support them in their old age. Some do, but most don't. Now, by the way, today in China, red China, communist China, we see a problem that's being created over there because China, did I mention this before, the one child policy? China is forcing abortions today, right, China, because to try to control the population, they're insisting that only one child per family. But in most of the Chinese, other than in the cities, more advanced areas of China, most Chinese still depend upon their children to take care of them in their old age. And if you have a daughter, the daughter becomes a part of her husband's family. So if you have a daughter, that's your only child, and you can't have any more. Then it's a daughter, then you have no one to take care of you in your old age. So what this is doing in China is that little girls are being killed and murdered so that the parents can have a boy to take care of them in their old age. The one child policy. So not only is China enforcing abortion, they're encouraging, as it were, infanticide of infants, of girls, maybe girls. Well, it may seem strange to us that at first Abraham's heir was a slave by the name of Eliezer. Now that Eliezer was going to inherit before Ishmael and Isaac were born. The adoption of slaves is known in the tablets from the archives of Nusu, and I'll give you the example, a citation. And some of these documents make clear the reason for and the nature of this relationship between Abraham and his adopted son, Eliezer. It was a custom at Nusu for childless people to adopt a son to serve them as long as they lived and to bury and mourn them when they died. Got that? So if you were childless, and your wife didn't have a handmaiden, or you didn't want to go that route, you could adopt somebody. Remember, Abraham and Sarah were childless. Apparently, they had decided not to go the handmaid route until after the promise was made. And so Abraham had followed the custom and adopted Eliezer. In exchange for these services, that is, to take care of them in their old age, to bury them and to mourn them, in exchange for this, he was adopted as an heir. However, if the adopted should beget a son, after the adoption, the adopted must yield to the real son the right of being chief heir. That's not really worded right. What it means is, that should be reworded. If the couple who adopted the slave or whoever they adopted to be the heir, if they had a child, then that child became the heir, no matter what. And the adopted slave or son was out as an heir. Thus we see the legal implications of God's reply in Genesis 15:4, "The slave shall not inherit thee, but he that shall come out of thine inward shall inherit thee." Well, this is also the background of Romans chapter 8. We're sons, not slaves. And if sons, then heirs. Slaves could not inherit. Now, the situation was slightly different in the Roman period, but that was the law. Since the purpose of marriage was procreation rather than romance and companionship to these people, it is not surprising that Nusu marriage contracts often go so far as to obligate the wife who fails to bear children to provide her husband with a handmaid who will bear them. And we've mentioned this. And I'll give you an example from the Nusu tablets. One of the marriage contracts says this, been translated, "If Gelumninu," she's the bride, the blushing bride, Gelumninu, by the way, one of the things this course will give you when you all have children in the future, you're searching for names, unusual names. I tried to get my wife to name one of our children Lugal Zagazi. I thought that was a king of the ancient world. Herb Elgatroyd was another choice that I had, and Mephibosheth, but I couldn't. Leslie, I wanted Leslie to be Herb Elgatroyd, and Aaron to be Lou Gehrig's agency, that my wife is very narrow-minded. She would not hear of it. So I'm going to be very proud of you if someday I hear that some of you have gotten married and you have a little girl named Gelungenu. That's beautiful, isn't it? You'll be the only one on the block with that name. Getting back to the marriage contract, if Gelungenu will not bear children, Gelungenu shall take a woman of Nalula land, that's where you got good slaves, as a wife for Shanima, who's the groom. You got that? She has a responsibility of digging up a handmaiden, or a choice slave, provide him to get children. This helps us understand the statement of Sarah to Abraham, quote, "The Lord has kept me from bearing. Go in, I pray, into my handmaiden Hagar. Perhaps I shall be built from her." That is, get descendants. To be built means to have descendants from her. Sarah's decision fits into the social pattern of the day. Two generations later, Rachel gives Bilhah to Jacob for the same reason. Genesis chapter 30, verse 3. After Hagar had borne Ishmael, Sarah was blessed with a son, Isaac. Resentful of Hagar and jealous of Isaac's future, Sarah tells Abraham, "Drive out this handmaiden and her son, for the son of this handmaiden shall not inherit along with my son Isaac." Now, here Sarah was out of line. The Nusu Code prohibited the wife to expel the handmaid under these circumstances. And what did God tell Abraham to do? "Go along with Sarah, and I'll take care of Hagar and Ishmael, and I'll make a nation of Ishmael." And God did this because Sarah was not within her rights. It required a divine dispensation. You got that? Abraham didn't want to comply. It was not according to custom. That's interesting, isn't it? Sarah shows her she was really fearful and jealous. So God says to Abraham, in effect, even though you're not supposed to do it this way, it's not the custom, you go ahead and send her away and I'll take care of things.
Is a handmaiden becoming a second wife lower class citizen?
No. The handmaiden become a second wife, she became simply a childbearer in this case.
What kind of rights did she have after the child was born? Was she usually taken care of?
Yes, she'd be taken care of. You see, Ishmael sort of became her son again when Isaac was born. Now, she was recognized as the child's mother, but legally the child belonged to the father. Although Egyptian contracts begin with the phrase, "I have made you my wife," most of these documents are primarily proprietary in character, dealing with the disposition of property. That is, many of these marriage contracts that come from Egypt were not drawn up at the time of the marriage, they were drawn up when children came along. Greek marriage contracts, dating from the late 4th century BC, have been preserved on papyri from Egypt. This is a Greek marriage. One document, this is 400 years before Christ, or 300 years before Christ or more. Between 300 and 400 years, Dionysius will feed and clothe Isadora. He will not maltreat her, nor outrage her, nor repudiate her, nor introduce any other woman into the house. Is that fair, fellas? Could a woman ask for more? Well, it's interesting. He would agree, and the girl's family would hold him to the contract. You know, if you wanted to rewrite marriage vows, you could use the Greek pattern. Whether we use sickness and health, poverty and wealth, do you promise to feed and clothe her? I do. Do you promise not to beat her too often? I do. Do you promise not to make her mad too often? Not to outrage her? I do. Do you promise not to divorce her? I do. Do you promise not to bring any other woman into the house? I do. Well, that would improve a lot of modern marriages, wouldn't it?
His wife was not to leave the house either by day or night without his consent, or else she would lose her dowry.
The Greeks had a very low view of women, lower than the Romans, certainly lower than the Christians. You get that? A Greek woman, when she was married, could not leave the house without his permission. Usually she couldn't leave alone either. If she was caught out of the house without his permission, day or night, then she would lose her dowry. But that was to protect the husband. In Rome, no ceremonies of a legal character were required to form a valid marriage. That is, they didn't have contracts in the Mesopotamian sense. All that was necessary was the intention to form a lasting union. In the early part of the Roman Empire, contracts listing the dowry were called tabulae nuptialis. The record of the wedding were inscribed as record of the marriage. They had marriage license, kind of. What we call a marriage license. Exodus 21 notes the husband's obligation to provide his wife with her food, her clothing, and her conjugal rights. That means sex. There was no reference to a marriage contract in the Old Testament. The apocryphal book Tobit, however, includes a reference to the inscribing of such a contract. This is from the intertestamental period. And you can read that. Just not anything particularly significant. In the 2nd century A.D., Rabbi Meir made the provision of a writ for the husband obligatory. That is, the Jewish husband was held responsible for his wife's medical treatment, for the support of her daughters until they were married, for the provision of an inheritance for her sons, and for the giving of her of a respectable funeral. That was very important to them. You got that? She got sick, had to take care of her, support her daughters till they got married, provide an inheritance for the sons, and bury her properly. Three complete marriage and four fragmentary contracts in Aramaic from the 5th century B.C. have been found at the Jewish garrison at Elephantine in Egypt. One of these, and I give you the citation there, records the formula, quote, "She is my wife, I am her husband from this day forever." That sounds very Christian, doesn't it? Aramaic and Greek contracts in the 2nd century A.D. have been found at Murabat and Nahal Hever on the western shore of the Dead Sea. One of these reads, quote, "You have become my wife according to the law of Moses." Quite straightforward. Okay, well, now we come to the actual ceremonies. And this is more interesting. In Mesopotamia, marriage was a civil affair, no religious ceremony. The wedding was celebrated in Sumer and Assyria by the act of anointing, pouring oil on the head. You know, the bride and groom will often feed each other wedding cake, or they would pour oil on one another, some kind of ceremony. Number 9, 30 weight olive oil, and it made for a smooth relationship. Everybody didn't like my joke, signified by saying I want an F for today.
I can't lie.
During the wedding, I like this one. During the wedding, the bride's face was covered, which may have explained the rabbis insisted that you see the bride before you marry her. Not really. That was considered modest. Today, the veil, by the way, We cheat. We have the wedding veil that you can see through. But in the Roman wedding, it was also covered. And the veil was a real veil. And it was pulled back after, you know, the ceremony, pulling it back after their husband and wife. He pulls back the veil and kisses her.
Have you ever seen them before then?
Yeah. But we have a veil you can see through, which kind of cheats. The Middle Assyrian laws prescribed severe penalties for wives who went out into the streets unveiled, and conversely for harlots who presumed to veil themselves. You got that? That the wives could not be seen by other men, but the harlots could not act as respectable women, the prostitutes. They had to go unveiled, and the women had to be veiled. Now, this custom, by the way, we find this kind of custom is reflected in the New Testament. Somebody tell me where. Corinthians, if a woman prays with her head uncovered, it's a shame. If a man prays with his head covered, it's a shame. Now, the covering of the head was not that's not the veiling of the face. But there was a complete covering of the head, which was considered a sign of modesty. Well, it's apparently happening in the church of Corinth was women who found new liberty in Christ were exploiting that liberty in a immature way, and praying with their heads unveiled, which was in that culture was a shame. Paul says, no, you're going too far. No evidence exists for any religious ceremonies involved in an Egyptian's wedding. The father of the bride conducted her, accompanied with rich gifts, to the groom's house. They had a feast. That was the wedding. I think we'll stop there for our break.
We're looking at ceremonies, and we are saying that for most ancient peoples, the wedding ceremony was not religious. While marriage may have been sacred and was sacred in most cases, the ceremony was what we would today call civil, and it really amounted to very little than the bride going to the house of the groom and feasts being involved, sort of celebration. With some little ceremonies. Now, in Greece, as I say in the syllabus, just before the wedding, the bride offered up her toys. She would have a little altar, and she would take her toys, childhood toys, and burn them. It makes you think about the statement of Paul in 1 Corinthians 13, when I became a man, I put away childish things. She dedicated a lock of her hair, had a nuptial bath, ceremonial bath, indicating a transition. She was going from childhood to adulthood, from being single to being married. She wore a veil. And keep in mind, these ancient veils covered the face. You could not see the face, not like a modern veil, which is transparent. The groom was dressed in bright garments. Remember this account of the Jesus parables about the wedding garment? Well, there were special clothes. Remember the man who tried to come into the king's wedding, the wedding feast of the king's son, without a wedding garment. There were special clothes given to people. After a feast at her father's house, she was put in a wagon, accompanied by the groom and the guests, in a merry torchlit procession to her new home. It's become a parade. As she entered it, nuts and dry figs were thrown at her as tokens of fertility. By the way, you know, don't you, that this is exactly the traditional significance of rice. Why you throw rice? When you're throwing rice at somebody, you're saying, whether you mean to or not, sure hope you have a lot of kids. In some of our cases, the rice was more effective than in others.
These words seem to
Well, it may be in some places because birds are eating the rice and dying of it. Yeah, and maybe some local ordinances, I don't know. Well, she said, did you hear what she said? In some places they're passing ordinances, you can't throw rice because the birds eat it and it kills them. And so they get throwing bird seeds. We always, you know, if you throw bird seed, you know, the birds will camp the mess. Bird seed doesn't quite say the same thing as rice. I mean, you say, if you throw rice, you're saying that you have a lot of children. If you throw birds, you're saying you're for the birds or whatever. Anyway, these tokens of fertility. The ancients were big on tokens of fertility. By the way, how did the rabbit and Easter eggs get associated with the resurrection of Christ? What is their connection? Well, there isn't any connection at all. It goes back to the connection. The connection is this old pagan Roman spring rite of rabbits because of their prolific ways and because of the obvious significance of eggs. Anyway, when she got back there after this torchlight parade, all her friends sang nuptial songs, and wedding songs to the god of marriage. Some of them are kind of raunchy. they sang to her. Well, so weddings were a big celebration. Among the Romans, the most auspicious season for weddings were April and the second half of June, and we have inherited that tradition, the June wedding. Before the wedding, the bride would surrender her toys and her childhood dress to the household god, just like the Greeks. On the morning of the wedding, the priest would sacrifice a pig. They used to kill a lot of pigs in those days. What they would do is, the priest would read the intestines of the pig to predict the prosperity and happiness of the marriage. The bride would be dressed in a white tunic of flannel or muslin. I'm thinking of muslin. Anyway, I'm not responsible for anything I say today. And we have preserved this tradition. The bride wears white. White as a symbol of purity, also figures in. She wore a veil of bright orange, which left her face exposed, as the Roman practiced. Sometimes, the bride would place her right hand in the right hand of the groom and said something like this, "Where you are Gaius, I will be Gaia." Now that did not mean... what that means is, here you see something much like our custom. As you know, the idea of having, well, first of all, what she was saying was that Gaius is the masculine form, Gaia is the feminine form of the same word. She took his name only in the feminine form of it. Now, this means that became her proper name. She didn't wear that name necessarily, though sometimes she might. But this idea of what we call a surname or last name is a late Western development. And the ancients didn't have surnames in the same way that we do. And this custom that we have preserved something like this in the bride taking the groom's surname, becoming the same name. Although, it gets very confused because in Finland, I think it's Finland, for instance, the children do not take the father's last name, they take his first name. And this confuses the matter, we'll get into that, but this has been a general custom. So that was something like that. The wedding feast was paid for by the groom, as always. We've preserved that, have we not? The groom's family pays usually for the kind of reception dinner, that's tradition.
The ceremonies were completed by the formal transfer of the bride to her new home. There you go again. So this formal changing of residences. The groom went ahead and scattered walnuts about him to the children. And it was the same thing of invoking the gods for fertility. And it was the Romans, from whom we borrowed the tradition of carrying the bride over the threshold. They did it because, see, there was a, it was considered unlucky. A woman stumbled over the threshold going into her home for the first time. It was considered a bad omen. So in order to make sure she would not stumble, the groom carried it. So she would not be a bad luck. If he stumbles? That's just a stupid question. I don't feel called upon to answer it. I do not know. In the Old Testament, and we have references to this. Somebody turn to Isaiah 61:10. Steve, turn to, let's get some of these scriptures ready. Isaiah 61:10 and Joe, Song of Solomon 3:11. You can find the Song of Solomon quickly. Leslie, Psalm 45:13-14. Psalm 45:13-14. Joe, Caputo, Isaiah 61:10. And anybody, Jeremiah 2:32. Who else? Genesis, Jeff, Genesis 29:22. Jude 14:12. Who wants to just go volunteer? Okay. Come on. No, that's not Jude. That's from the top. Apocrypha. I'm sorry. I'm looking at it wrong. Forget it, Mark. That's from Judah, from the top. Apocrypha. It's not Jude. Okay, got these scriptures ready. In the Old Testament, the groom was attired with a wreath. It's interesting. The groom wore the wreath, not the bride. Or a matrimonial crown, which to me makes a whole lot more sense than the bride wearing the wreath, because usually the groom is not as good looking as the bride and needs all the adornment he can get. As you notice, at a modern wedding, I always tell this when I'm counseling young men for a wedding, that they really don't count. The bride, her wedding, and she's the center of attention. He could wear overalls and nobody would notice. Well, maybe a couple people would notice, but the weddings are for brides. Well, it was the groom who wore this matrimonial crown. Isaiah 61:10 makes reference to this.
But I will rejoice greatly in the Lord, and my soul will exult in my God, for he has clothed me with garments of salvation. He has wrapped me with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decks himself with a garment. And as a bride adorns herself with jewels.
As a bridegroom decks himself with a garland. Song of Solomon 3:11.
Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon with the crown, with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart.
Okay. The bride was beautifully adorned with jewels. We've already had Isaiah 61, haven't we? Did we get that twice? The bride was beautifully addressed, adorned with jewels, and Isaiah 61, which Joe read, referred to the jewels. Read that again, Joe.
And as the bride adorns herself with her jewels.
With jewels. And she was veiled. Jewels and a veil. Psalm 45:13-14.
The king's daughter is all glorious again. Her clothing is usual and gold. She will be led to the king in her glory of work. The virgins, her companions who follow her, will be brought to speak.
And Jeremiah 2:32.
Does the maiden forget her jewelry, a bride, her wedding ornaments, the other people have forgotten these days without
them? Yeah, isn't that beautiful? To put that in modern terms, would a bride show up at the wedding and say, "Forgot my wedding dress"? Oh no, yet my people have forgotten me. Worse than that was her big day. Would she forget her jewelry, her wedding jewelry? It's quite graphic, is it not? The wedding feast might last a day. Genesis 29:22 is a reference to this.
The labor brought together all the people in that place and gave a feast.
Okay, well, in that case, it might last a week or even 2 weeks. Now, the reference in Genesis was not to the day, but to the feast, to the wedding feast. Now, what would make the difference how long it lasted? Well, a number of things. How large the family was, where they were located, how long it took them to get there, and primarily money. Feasts were very expensive. Food, let me say this to you to help us understand the ancient world, not just in this, but in other respects. You must understand that to the ancient world, about 80 to 90% or even more of their energies and their money, or both, were given simply to eating. And therefore, to prepare a feast was a tremendous expense. Take a big chunk of the budget. So it would depend largely upon the financial ability. And we have an account from the Apocrypha, and you can where Guel arranges the marriage feast of his daughter to Tobias. And I'm not going to read that over with you. You can see that. I put that in the... He starts out. He told his wife to bake a great batch of bread. He went to the herd and brought 2 oxen and 4 rams and told his servants to get them ready. So they set about preparations. He then called Tobias and said, "You should not stir from here for 2 weeks. Stay with us. Let us eat, drink together, and cheer my daughter's heart." But look at the amount of food. 2 oxen, 4 rams, great batch of bread. Is there any indication in the New Testament about which reflects the expense of a wedding feast? Or the problem involved? Canaan. What happened to Canaan? They ran out of wine. It was a great embarrassment. Apparently they had more people come than they thought.
What went on during that 2 weeks? I mean, obviously they were considering eating just for 2 weeks, but... Was this a celebration time? Was the time to get together?
It was kind of a running buffet. Well, they would have their set meal times, the feast, but the people would come and go. See, in the ancient world, you hear what he's asking? Let me just point this out and sort of give you a general picture which touches on not only this, but others, many other figures in the New Testament. In the ancient world, the main meal in the day, of course, was the evening meal. And the wedding feast was simply an intensification of the normal wedding feast. They were, this for instance, the giving of wedding garments, but they would normally give garments anyway. You see, the big thing in the day was the big meal in the day, the only meal that actually, what we would call sit down to eat, was the evening meal. And it was a social event. It took often 2 or 3 hours. They had courses, as they could afford, but they would eat and talk, and it would often go till bedtime. And during the day, they would eat we would call snack. Usually not sit down. They would just grab something off a sideboard from the night before, leftover, just snack. And as you know, they'd reclined at tables, did not sit. You know this, don't you? At tables, in fact, it's called a triclinium, and the tables were set like a horseshoe on 3 sides. You knew that, didn't you? 3-sided table. They were reclined perpendicular, so the servants washing the feet would go around the outside, and the people could have their feet washed while they're sitting. The person on the inside, the open inside, was where the servers could walk and serve them. The head of the table was Joe's seat. This did not exist, this table. As you all know this, I taught you this. The head of the table was Joe's seat. And he would face this way. And the one, that would be the host or whoever was the chief person. The one he wanted to honor the most, the honored guest, that he's the host, he would lay on his right elbow and face this way and eat. The honored guest would be in Daryl's seat. This was the... And the second most honored seat would be there, all around. This was the foot of the table over here. Sorry, Julian. Whereas we would think the head of the table would be up there. Like if we were having a speaker's table, we'd put the table at the head of the horseshoe. But it was second for the benefit of those on the tape who are hearing this by tape. It's on the horseshoe, it's on the left-hand arm of it, is the second from the end, was the chief seat.
And remember Jesus said, when you come into a feast, don't take one of the chief seats, take one of the lower seats, because if you take one of the chief seats, he's got that reserved for somebody else, he'll tell you to move on down. On the other hand, if you take one of the lower seats, he wants to honor you, he'll tell you to move on up. That's an honor. It was a humiliation to be told to move down, an honor to be told to move up. By the way, we know at the Last Supper where some of them were sitting. We know that John was sitting here. I'm sorry, that Judas was sitting here, and it was normally Peter's seat. And we know that John was sitting there, Jesus, of course, was sitting there, and that Peter was sitting over here. How do we know that?
Not from the painting.
Not from the painting, no. You know about the painting, don't you? Da Vinci's Last Supper. The reason he painted it that way is only he knew to get everybody in the picture. Anyway, we know that because Jesus could talk with Judas and the rest of them not here. And Jesus laid his head back on John's bosom and spoke to him. Jesus dipped in the same dish with Judas. And Peter could nod to John, ask him, without the others seeing. And what happened was, this was Peter's seat, and Judas had decided that boldness was the best policy since he had decided to betray Jesus. So he came and took Peter's seat, and Peter got mad and took Judas' seat. Or at least took the end. Understand? I mean, we know Peter was sitting in one of these seats right here because he could nod to John. Cross. Also, when you got ready to wash feet, you stopped at the bottom and worked up. And who did Jesus come to first when he started to wash the feet? Came to Peter. Well, anyway, now we're talking about the fact that these weddings were intensifications of this. When somebody came to the feast, you would do three. If they came a long way, you would do three things, or have it would be done for them. Number one, they would be given a garment, probably for two reasons. First of all, if they were poor, this isn't a normal feast. Maybe not an evening, not every evening meal, but if you had any kind of feast. In other words, if you had company coming in, then that feast would be a welcoming feast. If they traveled, you would give them a garment to wear, probably for two reasons. Number one, if they were poor, they would be embarrassed. They don't have to, could not look decent. Secondly, it would be dirty. It was very dirty to travel in those days by foot. Second, they would anoint the head with oil. And the servant would anoint their head. That was for cleaning. That's how they cleaned their hair. They put oil on it. The very cheapest of the third or fourth pressing of the olive press. And then comb it out. And you can clean your hair very well that way. At least it oiled it. But they didn't mind. That oily hair was not a sin in the ancient world. It's an abomination today. But although it's coming back.
Third or fourth pressing, they had mousse.
Yeah, mousse. They would put, you understand, they'd put the oil in there, rub it in, and then comb the hair, and the dirt would come out with the oil. And then, of course, they would wash the feet. This is the significance of what Mary did with the precious ointment, precious oil, the muron, the Greek word, is that she anointed his head and feet with this very precious scented oil. Rather than the cotton, they would normally use it. They would use the oil that was too bad, too low grade, to either burn or to cook with. And so they would use the wash, and she used the very most expensive scented oil and washed Jesus' head. You understand? So, at a wedding feast, they had special garments. They'd do all this. But they would have the special garments for a wedding. And that was part of the responsibility. You provide the garments. And this figures into some of the parables of Jesus. And, Darrell, you ask how long? They wouldn't just sit and eat the whole time. No, they would have the evening meals. And it would be a series of evening meals. But the people, as far as we can tell, they would come and just have a family reunion. They'd come and visit, and people would come and go. That is, you see, people would come long distances, and travel was uncertain, times were uncertain. Some of them came Florida Express, so they always arrived late. That is, you would have, I have one set of people for one evening meal, and then some of them be gone and newcomers in for the second evening meal, and then some of those be gone and others come in for the third evening. In other words, you give time for the family to come in and celebrate it, relatives coming from a distance. And so that you would have people stay there at the end of the week, but not have that first week.
Yes. When it came to the end of the wedding feast, then they would go to the groom's house. That marked the end of it. Well, I'm getting into it here. Let me come to this. The New Testament, in the New Testament, of the wedding feast were given by the groom's family, would be attended by guests suitably attired. And I made reference to this. Somebody read Matthew 22. Well, I made reference to this about the wedding garment. Jesus performed his first miracle at the marriage feast at Cana of Galilee, recorded in John chapter 2, as we all know. The procession to the groom's house, this is what you're asking, took place late at night. And the reference to this in Matthew 25. What is Matthew 25, 1 through 13? What is that? Somebody tell me. The parable of what? 10 virgins, 10 wise and 10 foolish. Luke 12, 35 through 38. Friends of the bridal parties, called children of the bride chamber, played important roles in the nuptial festivities. Somebody read Matthew 9, 15. Friend of the bride chamber, or children of the bride chamber. These were friends, these were special friends. Somebody read Matthew 9:15 for us. First one that finds it.
Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he is with them? The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, then they will fast."
Okay, he's talking about this guest of the bride. He's talking about this class of people who were intimate friends, who would rejoice. They would be there for, if the feast lasted 6 days, they'd be there all 6 days. Real close friends. And what he says is, Jesus uses this as a figure, he says, they don't mourn while the bridegroom is there, they mourn when he's gone. While he's there, that's the time for celebration. John the Baptist called himself the friend of the bridegroom in relation to Christ. John 3:29, he says, "I am not the bridegroom, I am the friend of the bridegroom." What do we call that today? The best man. Exactly the same role. A very close friend. Now, getting back to this, when the wedding actually took place, toward the end of the feast, when the feasts were over at the groom's house, given by the groom's family, they would go to the groom's home. The feast would be at his father's house, ideally, if all the family were intact. You understand? Because this was the last goodbye. The feast would be at the father's house, and if it lasted 6 days, well, at the end of the sixth day, then they would, with their close friends, ceremonially go to the groom's house, his own house, and that was the wedding. That was the end of it. Trouble is, you didn't know exactly when. They didn't go by clocks in those days. That is, they were coming after the feast, and so you could not. You have to guess as to when they were going to call it off. See, the ancients operated like this. Here, we operate this way, that we start at a certain time and quit at a certain time by the clock. The ancients didn't do that very much. They did some. Not with the precision that we do. Their theory was you started when everybody got there and you quit when you were finished. And so it was very uncertain in time. And the parable of the wise and foolish virgin, these were friends of the bridegroom who were waiting for the party to come, to mark the end and the completion of the wedding, to celebrate with him. And they did, the bridegroom tarried. He didn't come, and they were not prepared. They ran out of oil. Does that help you to understand? And as I say, it's very important because this figure. Let me also say one more thing to you. It is indicative of how big a thing this was in that culture. How many times Jesus used, and the New Testament writers used this figure of the in various ways.
But you have the king giving a wedding feast for his son. The Book of Revelation, the marriage of the bride has come.
I think it's interesting that Jesus would perform it. Jesus took time out. Jesus was beginning his ministry. Now think about this. Jesus had just got together his freshman class, was just starting, and he took time out to come to a wedding, to go to Cana, which was out of the way, probably, to where he was going. Cana was kind of a out-of-the-way place. But it shows, what I'm saying is, that we keep running into the wedding, or the wedding feast, or something about it, in the New Testament, from a number of directions.
in a number of connections. It suggests strongly, and it bears out what we know from other sources, that this was a very vital part in their lives. Much more even so today. Now, even traditionally, I know that the wedding, I think, is probably the biggest day of a young woman's life, a wedding day. But to them, it was much more. It was a family event. Families were much more involved in weddings than in marriages and weddings than they are now, even though they're very heavily involved. But it was just a big event and very important. And there were very strict customs that had to be followed. For instance, to be invited to the wedding feast was a great honor. Even to eat with someone was a great honor. Well, let me say this, and we sort of lost this in our fast food culture, and the middle class has lost this. The upper class sustains it. Eating as a social event. You know, we eat and run. That's our, you know, we sit at the table to process food so we can get on to other things, don't we, most of the time. Fast food craze is the ultimate in this. But the ancients, they just did not particularly, it took all day to prepare the meal. Somebody would have to work all day to get us a full meal together. And so then they would spend all evening eating it. Especially a wedding feast. And as I said, let me come back to it. You see the great humiliation that was involved in running out of wine? And that was, I don't know why they ran out, but it was a tremendous. That would be known. That would be a mark against that family for the rest of their lives, for the rest of that generation. Great human. Anyway, it's not like, hey, we're out of milk. You know, forget it. Eat your cornflakes without it. No, we're out of wine. It's a big thing. The reasons I've given. Okay. Any questions on that? To answer your question about when the wedding took place, what we would call the wedding. Anyone else? The early church retained many elements of the Roman wedding, we've been saying. I've mentioned some of these. The bride's veil was purple and white in the early church. Why purple and white? White was royalty and purity. Instead of the pagan sacrifice, Christians substituted the celebration of the Lord's Supper. The Roman Catholic Church, by the way, preserves this very early tradition. And it raises a controversial issue. Some Christians feel, I have friends, who feel very strongly that the Lord's Supper should be held only on the first day of the week. Others feel that it is okay to hold the Lord's Supper at other times, such as at weddings. And many have the Lord's Supper at their weddings. Myself, I do not object to having the Lord's Supper at other times, but I do not go out of my way to encourage it. I think the Lord's Supper was for the church when it came on the first day of the week, and I am a little bit uncomfortable with using it at other times, although I would not make an issue of it, and do not. But here's an example where the church began to use the Lord's Supper, the communion, for every wedding. Part of every wedding now, and Roman Catholic, you had a Roman Catholic wedding and know anything about it, isn't it? Every part, every wedding. But they did it because these were pagans, just out of paganism, and they wanted to, the policy of their early church, whether it was wise or not, was to substitute. So they substituted the Lord's Supper for the killing of the pig and the other pagan sacrifices. That's your hand, Brian. Yeah.
But it also the fact that it was still socially bad, wouldn't most of the church have been there anyway? Most likely.
Do what now?
If the wedding feast was as large of a socially event as it is, would not most of the church have been to it anyway?
Not necessarily. They would certainly. We don't know. It depends on the family and the situation. Like some weddings today, all the church comes to some, and not so much comes to others, depending on a lot of other things. It's interesting that the fact that they would celebrate the Lord's Supper shows that they were Christians only married Christians. It was a Christian event. They simply did not tolerate this idea of Christians marrying non-Christians in the early church, in the first century church. In Byzantine times, this is after 325.
The promise to love was added to marriage contracts. Interesting. Where you agreed to love, like at the wedding vows, to love, honor, and obey, and cherish, or obey, or whatever. That was added. Bishop Ambrose, remember him from early Christian centuries? He was the fellow who didn't want to be bishop. He was from Milan. He was kind of like the mayor, and he was baptized and became a bishop through the whole orders in one day. He permitted decorous celebrations, but denounced the wanton behavior at pagan weddings. That is, he reluctantly permitted the Christians to decorate and to celebrate, but he really denounced the behavior of pagan weddings. Let me tell you, pagan weddings were raunchy. That is, they would tell jokes and do all kinds of... And even in the medieval world, weddings in the medieval world, in Christendom, supposedly Christian, were very raunchy. It was a very bawdy, raucous time. And some weddings today are like that. I was always... whenever I was in the local ministry and had a lot of weddings, we didn't have a lot of weddings, but had weddings every year, I always did my best to make sure that, because often you would have non-Christians coming to the wedding, and we had people come in and throw a cigarette down on the carpet and rub it out with their feet. It's amazing how you get Americans who have no idea how to conduct themselves in a church. And we learned we had to predict that, because you have members of the family, somebody who... relatives come in who just had no who were just pagans, ignorant pagans, some with master's degrees, but still ignorant pagans when it came to a church. And so we found we had to put up no smoking signs and protect our carpets. And of course we allowed no liquor or whatever at the reception, and other things. Even with our best efforts. Often they would paint bawdy things on the car when they're ready to leave, which are really not, at best, in poor taste, at worst, pornographic. But that's a real problem. You can't always control that. We did the best we could. Well, Bishop, I remember saying early on that the church leaders, church fathers, tried to make sure the Christians didn't do what the pagans did. Let me say this to you, that for you going to the local ministry, weddings are a real opportunity to do some strong teaching. People listen to you, and to uphold the sanctity of marriage, to make it a very beautiful wedding. I didn't have very many weddings because I would not marry some people because of divorce involved, and I would not because of the circumstances surrounding divorces that you all know about, and I wouldn't marry a Christian to a non-Christian, and it didn't make any sense to me to spend all week trying to establish Christian homes and then Friday night establish a non-Christian home. But anyway, when I did have a wedding, I always wrote a separate ceremony and tried to really make it nice and emphasized it, really worked hard on it, because you can really do some valuable teaching. You can create an attitude, a mood among young Christians to help the marriage. It's an opportunity. Too often, because they're a headache, a wedding is 10 times the trouble a funeral is. Because they're such a headache, often preachers want to just kind of brush through them, and get it over with. But I urge you, we put out some effort, young couple. It pays off. See where it pays off. It pays off when younger children come up and their older sisters and brothers get married. If you really emphasize this, they get the message in time. Well, anyway, although Ignatius counseled, it befits those marrying and being given in marriage should enter upon their union with the approval of the bishop, so their marriage may be according to the Lord and not from lust. Neither episcopal approval nor ecclesiastical blessing was necessary to validate marriages in the early church. They didn't have to do it. They was encouraged. They did not have to get permission of the eldership or the bishop in the second century when they got a monarchical bishop. They didn't have to do that. It was not until the fifth century that ecclesiastical benedictions became a universal custom. That is, until you had to get the permission of the church.
And in the 6th century, a special form of marriage service became common. You got that? Until the 6th century, there was no regular, traditional marriage service. Everybody sort of did their own. Now, as you know, what we use as the traditional, the traditional non-Catholic wedding is Anglican. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here in the sight of God. This kind of, that comes from the Anglicans. But that has sort of been the form, although there's grand departure from it, and I don't think it's sacrosanct, of course. But the point is, the Roman Catholic Church now, of course, has a very strictly prescribed liturgy for marriage. It's always the same. And often, high church weddings tend to be very cut and dried because you go through the liturgy, prescribed liturgy. I recall I went to a wedding, my wife and I went to a wedding last year, and it was very expensive in the chapel at Rollins College. And you could tell it cost a wad for everything, just to get the building or something. And yet, the wedding itself, this Episcopal priest came out. He looked like he would just stop by on his way home from a dog fight. Threw his robes on, came out and read the wedding, and left. Very perfunctory, you know, read the ceremony. I thought, well, that's so, I put out that much money, I'd like to have a little more spontaneity or whatever, feeling into it. But that's kind of the practice in high liturgical churches. Well, next we come to, that's so much for any questions on ceremonies. You've heard about it. Look at the ancient world. Well, I'm going to talk about ceremonies later. One of my running jokes is the difference is the vast difference between the ceremony and the wedding. Often we have ceremonies that are very idealistic, don't do much preparing us for weddings, but I might say something about that later. Come now to marriage in Roman Catholic theology. This gets more interesting now. We're through with the boring stuff, by the way. Everybody understand that? You've been... The boring part is over. I want you to notice that I did hurry through it, did I not? And I did not over-labor it. I hope you're not too bored to study when you, because when we come to the end of the first session, we're going to have an exam. It won't be too much, and it won't be too long. So
it won't be too boring.
It won't be. The exam will be delightful, exciting. I wish we had time. This was a semester course to stage a first century wedding feast. Try to reproduce from the information that we have. If y'all want to do it, I'll give you extra credit for it. Wouldn't that be fun? In place of what? In place of your project?
In place of your baby.
Would y'all really do that in place of baby eggs? No. You gotta do baby eggs. Y'all think about it. See what I'll do. If some of you want to go together and try to stage it, if you give me the plan ahead of time, and so it's orderly and of substance, I'll let you do that in place of the exam on the first half, and you all get the same grade. I'll grade it. y'all think about it, but you have to be researched and all the information, and it'll be a lot of fun. We'll all participate, but only those who put it on will get the grade for it. But it has to be very tight, understand? I have to have the names, I have to have a project description. It has to be done right, not just thrown together. Yes. It'd be easier to take the exam, by the way. Much easier. Yes. About what?
I have a question about the thing. And the senior going to take the finals. How much would this midterm count? How do you want to work that out?
The way I'm going to work it out is, if the senior is content with the grade on the exam, the midterm, the senior still has to have the project. So they'll have the project and the exam on the first section.
if the senior is content, if you're content with your grade, let that be your grade, fine. If not, if you want to, if you think it's too low, I'll let you, I'll give you an exam early on the second part. By the way, those who, the baby egg, will not, those who have children already won't have to do baby egg. I'll get something else for you, which is hard, which is harder. No. No. Okay. While we're on the subject, anybody got any more questions? Are some of you seriously would like to stage a first century wedding feast? Well, you have to. No, I'm talking about a Christian wedding. Christian wedding. Or it could be the Christian wedding, or the other wedding in the first century Jewish wedding, like the one. Why don't you reproduce the wedding feast in Canaan? Use that as your script if you're going to do it. And which, in other words, you can act that out like a Bible drama, but emphasize the historical aspects of the wedding. And have the, you have to have the processional to the groom's house and everything. You ought to write it up. You all decide. Think about it. Don't commit yourself. It's a lot more work. You understand what I'm saying? It's a lot more work than the exam. And I have to have it all, you know, decently and in order. And I'll grade it, give everybody the same grade. And there has to be good participation. And what happens is, if some of you really participate well, you got two or three here just tagging along and not really hitchhiking on it, I'll just lower the whole grade and everybody will get a low grade. What's that? That too. Okay. We're coming to any other any questions on that? Well, don't decide hastily. Think about it. Talk about it. Any other questions? Yes. I'll let you know at the time. Pardon? What are you talking about? Where is that? What are you talking about? Oh, yes. I forgot that I put in the syllabus. I don't know how I got stuck in. That may have got stuck in accidentally. Oh, it is. Oh, I see. Yes. Yes. That I forgot that was in there when I reproduced this. That will be your project. Forget the date.
When would that be due?
I'll announce that later. Yes. Well, I'll tell you later.
Only if you plan on boiling your children when you go.
You already got the stipulations. You can start. It's already written up in the syllabus. Okay, let's take our break before we start.